Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
It's time now for 360 on ABC Radio National.
360.
Stories.
People.
Ideas.
Essays.
Sound.
Around the world. It became an obsession.
And I'm sure too they don't forget my voice.
Documentaries. Features. 360.
Hi, Brent Clough here, back in the chair after a few weeks away. Thanks to Kirsty Melville for filling in. Inviting you now to join us on an exploration of the sometimes dark art of persuasion. Whether it's called propaganda, PR, advertising, marketing, lobbying, or spin, the agents of persuasion are chasing us like never before. Now said to outnumber journalists by 4-1, the persuaders are constantly evolving. Their various worlds have been captured in TV shows like Mad Men, The Gruen Transfer, and The Hollow Men. But that's only a small part of the story, as producer Nick Franklin discovers in this journey into the past, present, and future of the persuaders.
Good morning, Parliament House.
Hello, Parliament House.
Yes, Ryan.
Look, can you put me through to the Prime Minister's press office, please?
Yes, one moment.
Hello, press office.
Hi, Nick Franklin here from ABC Radio National. Look, I'm researching a piece about the art of persuasion and would like to interview you about how that works in the PM's office. Particularly wanted to ask you about a private meeting between the PM and the head of Chinese propaganda. Wondering if I can record an interview with you now.
Oh, okay, well, can you just forward through a formal request?
I'd first heard about Kevin Rudd's private meeting at the lodge with Mr. Lee from an unusual source. While I was walking to work one day, going through a pedestrian tunnel not far from the ABC, a short Chinese woman appeared out of the shadows, smiled at me, and thrust a paper into my hands. And there it was on the front page, under the headline,
PM Rudd's secrecy protects Chinese communist official. The lack of transparency surrounding Prime Minister Kevin Rudd's meeting with Li Changchun, head of the Chinese communist regime's propaganda, media and ideology, has never been effectively explained. Epoch Times, 9th of April, 2009.
Given this report appeared in a paper produced by Falun Gong, a movement with good reasons to attack the Chinese government, it'd be easy to dismiss it as, well, as a piece of propaganda itself. But I think it also shows an acute sensitivity to that word and all it's come to mean. Wherever we turn today, the persuaders are after us. Sometimes their approach is so obscure, we don't really know what's happening.
That there are known knowns, there are things we know that we know. There are known unknowns. That is to say, there are things that we now know we don't know. But there are also unknown unknowns. There are things we do not know we don't know.
In Harvey Norman's massive half-yearly clearance...
At other times, the noise is deafening.
Oh, flash to 7.95!
There's fun for everyone.
More singlets, flash!
Either way, no one before us in human history has ever been subjected to so much of it.
So no chance of me persuading you to do an interview about the art of persuasion?
Not quite, yeah. So if you're after an interview...
I'd started off wanting to make a program about contemporary propaganda, but quickly realised that although it's all around us, no one's actually owning up to doing it. The Macquarie Dictionary defines propaganda as
the systematic propagation of a given doctrine.
Particular doctrines or principles propagated by an organisation or movement.
Dissemination of ideas or information or rumour for the purpose of injuring or helping an institution, a cause or a person.
You know something?
Terrorism has changed the world.
Those working families.
Aspiration and fairness.
And lowering the take-home pay of many working families.
Yes, we can.
Aspirational nationalists.
Six broken promises in a row.
And patriotism.
As interest rates have gone up and up.
Be alert, but not alarmed.
And up and up.
Together,
Let's look out for Australia. And up.
Quiet, understated pride.
Authorised Tea Gartrell, ALP Canberra.
And then he'll force us to drink recycled sewage.
While we're not surprised that the Chinese have a propaganda chief, we don't like to think of ourselves involved in the same game. If you ask people in the marketing business about propaganda, they get uncomfortable with the word and quickly tell you why.
Propaganda means lie.
Does it?
To people. I think propaganda instantly suggests a distortion of the truth.
Even though the word lie doesn't appear in any of the Macquarie's definitions of propaganda, it's understandable why Matt Jones believes what he believes. It all goes back to the man sometimes called the father of modern advertising. Hitler's propaganda chief, Dr. Joseph Goebbels, had no qualms about linking propaganda with lying.
When you tell a lie, tell a big lie.
I quickly discovered that although people are loath to associate their work with propaganda, most have no problems talking about the business of persuasion. Even though their meanings overlap, persuasion doesn't carry the baggage of propaganda.
Propaganda is, in my mind, and maybe this is not accurate, propaganda is a word that's not dissimilar to another word that's used to describe people like me, which is spin.
Phil Davey is a modern persuader, a one-man publicity machine, working from his home in the Blue Mountains, west of Sydney, and from his car. It's a simple operation. The tools of his trade are a laptop, a BlackBerry, and a mobile phone.
G'day, I was after Andrew West at the Sydney Morning Herald, please. Oh, Westy, Phil Davey again. Look, I won't hold you up. I'm just going to send you an advance copy of Gary Weaven's speech to this conference tomorrow.
I'm spending 2 days with Phil Davey, tracking his attempts to get the media interested in covering a conference organised by one of his clients, Catalyst, a relatively new left-wing think tank.
I don't really regard myself as a propagandist at a day-to-day level, in the same way that I don't really regard myself as a spin doctor, because whilst I will proselytise my own angle, of course, and try and put my client's point of view in the best possible way, 8 or 9 times out of 10, at the heart of the yarn, there is something that is real, that is often quite dramatic, and therefore newsworthy. And it means that, I guess, in my own mind, I differentiate myself a little bit from what I perceive as the real spin doctors, who would be the government communications directors, the PR agencies that manage messaging on behalf of big corporations, the darker side of manipulation.
Advertising is based on one thing, happiness. And you know what happiness is? Happiness is the smell of a new car. It's freedom from fear. It's a billboard on the side of the road that screams with reassurance that whatever you're doing, it's okay. You are okay.
Come fly with me, let's fly away.
The TV series Mad Men, set in the world of American advertising in the 1960s, takes me back to my childhood and reminds me that I too was a persuader before I even realised it. I have in front of me a reminder, a faded black and white photograph from a newspaper ad at the time. It shows a dirty little boy, muddy knees, hands and face, contrasting with the sparkling white underwear he's modelling. The boy's head is being held over a wash basin. His expression, a grimace. Presumably, it's the prospect of being forcibly washed by his mother, who's clutching his hair. I was 7. It was my first job, and it'd be a long time before I earned the same amount of money for an hour's work. Of course, like most ads, it was mostly unreal. The dirt on my hands, face and knees was really makeup. The wash basin wasn't connected to anything, just standing in a photographer's studio under very bright lights. and the woman who was supposed to be my mother was actually my father's secretary. And the reason I was pulling her face was because she was pulling my hair after several failed attempts to induce the right expression.
Pack a small bag.
My father had a love-hate relationship with advertising. A coal miner's son who'd really wanted to be a journalist, he'd started at the bottom, working his way up to becoming an agency director. It gave him a good living, and in the process, he developed advanced bullshit detectors.
This is where it begins. The better taste of Lucky Strike with tobacco. Fine tobacco. Tobacco that's grown and harvested and cured with gentle care. Light, naturally mild, good-tasting tobacco. And something else. Just before that fine tobacco is made into Lucky's, it's toasted. It's toasted to taste even better.
Everybody else's tobacco is poisonous. Lucky Strike's is toasted.
It's toasted. I get it.
I've got a big tactical advantage over the marketeers, you know, the people who will be employed to devise an advertising campaign, your billboard salespeople, because people make a distinction between advertising or marketing and what I do, which is media. And that's one of the big selling points when I pitch for work. I say, you could pay me a few grand a month to run your PR and get you in the papers, or you could spend $15,000 every 6 months buying a half-page ad in a major paper, but the half-page ad will still be perceived at the end of the day as an advertisement, no matter how well designed, whereas a newspaper article which we've generated, which quotes you and is about your issues, is perceived as news.
As we hit the expressway heading for the city, Phil's car flashes under a bridge carrying a huge message from Optus. A billboard ad pushing their powers of communication. It's a reminder that while he's also in the communication business, he doesn't have the big dollars of the big corporates. His client is a small, low-budget, relatively unknown think tank.
Well, for a little embryonic organisation like my client Catalyst, who are, you know, fairly central to putting this conference on, it's pretty important to develop a profile because they do a lot of very good policy development work. They write some very rigorous submissions to government inquiries and the like. But for them, it's crucial because they can produce the most magnificent policy documentation in the world. But if no one's reading about it or hearing about it, then it's really only a dozen or so people who are going to wade through it. Whilst ever the name Catalyst is more associated with the ABC science show than it is with a left-wing think tank, it's hard yards.
At this stage of the story, I've no idea how well Phil's going to go. I do know that for any kind of story, you have to have a narrative. And that's something that can be constructed by all kinds of persuaders. Take the case of this man.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
For those of us old enough, one of the strongest where were you when questions relates to President Kennedy and his assassination. I remember as a teenager hearing the news at a school assembly. I was standing next to an American exchange student who was sobbing uncontrollably. Kennedy had seemed so different to the usual world leaders of the time, who were mostly, to my young eyes, old and ugly. Whereas Kennedy was not only young, vigorous and handsome, but also a war hero. I can't recall exactly how my image of JFK was constructed, the various persuasive forces that had built it in my mind. And I certainly didn't know then what I know now.
His father had a lot of money and spent big on JFK's election to Congress. The money was used with public relations, what is often called propaganda. It was necessary to his success.
Mark Rolfe lectures and researches politics and propaganda at the University of New South Wales.
That's where you get the start of his wartime hero narrative. that he injured his back as a PT boat commander in the Southwest Pacific, and he certainly was very brave. However, the back had a longer history than that PT accident. He had back problems starting in the 1930s when he was a student. He had irritable bowel syndrome, possibly celiac disease as well, but he was taking cortisone. It was unknown in those days the side effects of cortisone. He was developing osteoporosis as a side effect. So the drugs were aggravating those conditions. Then from 1951, he was taking Novocaine injections for his back. During the 1960 presidential campaign, he was taking amphetamines to keep pace with the campaign. He was also taking Lomotil, phenobarbital, testosterone, tranexamfetamine for diarrhea and abdominal discomfort and weight loss, penicillin and other antibiotics, also Tylenol to help him sleep. And there were a range of possibly other drugs that nobody knows because only Kennedy knew. There was no one in charge. One biographer said he was more promiscuous with doctors and drugs than he was with women. And we know his history there.
In the probing and manipulating, nothing is immune or sacred.
The Hidden Persuaders, Vance Packard's bestseller on advertising, features the kind of ideas propagated in TV's Mad Men.
Certain of the probers, for example, are systematically feeling out our hidden weaknesses and frailties in the hope that they can more efficiently influence our behaviour.
I can remember my father buying Packard's book early on and indicating that he thought Vance was very much on the money. Whether you're selling washing powder, a car, or a president, there's usually an angle.
My wife says I work too hard. She may be right. The days certainly are filled with the demands and tensions of a high-powered job. But I've got an escape hatch. I call it my Cadillac hour.
The automobile has become far more than a means of conveyance. In the words of Pierre Martineau, the automobile tells us who we are and what we want to be.
My first car was a Fiat 600. If I was honest with myself at the time, I'd have admitted that one of the main features that persuaded me to buy it was the fact that it had a sunroof, which I could pull back and allow the wind to rush through my hair. The doctor who sold me the Fiat left the country the next day. 2 months later, the car started making strange noises. I left it with a mechanic, who a couple of hours later took some joy in asking me,
"Do you know what you're driving? Do you know what you're driving?"
"Yes, it's a Fiat 600.
"Well, yeah, but actually you're driving around on a washing machine lid."
He showed me under the car, where half the floor had rotted away under the driver's seat. And there, someone had welded the top of a washing machine. And then I go and spoil it all by saying something stupid like I love you. 20 years later, I got to interview the copywriter who worked on this ad.
With a 2.6-litre petrol engine or a turbo diesel, it delivers torque as well as power. The Mitsubishi Pajero. Every drive is an adventure.
The hideous truth is most people's lives are very ordinary, very ordinary. We live, if we didn't have our dreams, our lives would just crumble about us. So the imagery that we associated with that particular car in that particular commercial is of the dream of the person who's stuck in traffic on Parramatta Road or wherever it may be, heading home, thinking, gee, if I had my way, if the world were mine, if I could make my dreams come true, I'd be an explorer again. It's really boys' own annual stuff, effectively.
Joe, good. Please forward both of those to me, and I'll pitch them round. Just heard back from John Karen at the Financial Review just moments ago. He's going to run the Weaven stuff. So
as we leave the city on the eve of the conference, Phil Davey is hoping to drum up enough interest among journalists for a preview piece.
Andrew West coming from the Herald, and there's a couple of others, but we need to try and get some oxygen for this thing, so make a few calls over the course of the afternoon and evening, and then hit the phones again in the morning and try and rustle up some interest. There's still a view out there that you are getting media when you're in print, and there isn't quite the same recognition for online, certainly amongst older people. That's still the case. Hello? Hi, John. How'd you go? Okay, so you're going to do something, but it's not going to be huge sort of thing.
In promoting the conference, Phil Davies is comfortable with his client, the morals, ethics and beliefs that go with the territory. Others in the persuasion business have far more lethal products to push.
And our final guest today is Nick Naylor. Mr. Naylor is the vice president of the Academy of Tobacco Studies. Now, they are the tobacco industry's main lobby in Washington, D.C., and Mr. Naylor is their chief spokesman.
Few people on this planet know what it is to be truly despised. Can you blame them? I earn a living fronting an organization that kills 1,200 human beings a day. 1,200 people. We're talking two jumbo jet plane loads of men, women, and children. I mean, there's Attila, Genghis, and me, Nick Naylor, the face of cigarettes, the Colonel Sanders of nicotine.
In Thank You for Smoking, Aaron Eckhart plays a charismatic spin doctor for Big Tobacco. As a satire on the dark side of lobbying, Thank You for Smoking works almost too well. There appears to be a formula that says the dirtier the product, the more you can earn.
But I can certainly say that I could double or triple my income if I went and worked for what I perceive with my belief system to be the dark side. But, you know, truth has a funny way of coming out, I reckon, Nick. You look at the campaign to get James Hardie to pay the victims of its product proper compensation into perpetuity. Now, that company did what most people in the community would regard as the wrong thing. And I know, because I went to uni with some of their spin doctors, they had the best media advice that money could buy. But it did them no good in the end, because the story that we were telling from the union/victim side of things was so compelling and so obvious to even the most casual observer that it didn't matter how much spin they threw at the issue, they were going to get precisely nowhere. And I actually find that tremendously encouraging at a professional level, because what it tells me, that campaign and others like it, enthusiastic, self-taught people like me who are a bit motivated and have a bit of fire in their belly and a bit of passion for what they're doing can actually often kick the heads in of these super well-paid, very well-trained media spin doctor professionals. We wipe the floor with them because, like I say, truth has a funny way of coming out in the end.
Most importantly, we've got spin control. That's where I come in. I get paid to talk.
Obviously a heated issue, and we do have a lot that we want to cover today. Nick, do you have a question?
Joan, how on earth would Big Tobacco profit off of the loss of this young man? Now, I hate to think in such callous terms, but if anything, we'd be losing a customer. It's not only our hope, it's in our best interest to keep Robin alive and smoking.
That's ludicrous.
Let me tell you
the
something.
The truly awful thing about watching Nick Naylor in action is that it's almost impossible not to like him, despite the bullshit that pours from his mouth. And here I think we come to an essential ingredient in the persuasion business, charm.
A $50 million campaign aimed at persuading kids not to smoke. Because I think that we can all agree that there is nothing more important than America's children.
At the end of the 20th century, while making a program about the selling of Adolf Hitler, I interviewed a woman who actually met the Führer just before the Second World War.
My encounter with Hitler was in a lift going up three floors. I'm going to say something quite dreadful. He was not unattractive. I mean, he was not attractive to me, I have to say, but he had a magnetism. The woman with me was the head of the French Red Cross, a French princess. And I was her interpreter, right? I was just a little girl interpreting for her. And he shook hands with both of us and looked at us in this way he had, you know, of a very, very direct and Speer said they all called it the deep look.
Author Gitta Serony, who wrote a biography of Hitler's architect, Albert Speer. My father told me a story about how, just before the Second World War, a young German woman visited his north of England hometown and boasted how she'd once danced with Hitler and planned to keep wearing her Hitler dancing shoes forever. Hitler's powers of persuasion were strong enough to get his people to go to war. It's another reason why marketing people like to put a big distance between themselves and propaganda. The truth is that politics, propaganda, and product promotion have strong links, which go back a long way.
Well, last I read, Nixon was running without an agency.
Make no mistake, we know better what Dick Nixon needs. Better than Dick Nixon.
Well, they think they're set without us. Why chase a girl that doesn't want to get caught?
You have a problem with Nixon?
I don't vote.
Yeah. But politics aside, these last 8 years have been good to us because they've been good to Procter and Gamble and the United Fruit Company, etc.
So whether Dick Nixon likes it or not,
we will give our people what they want.
Mad Men touches on the strong connections between advertising, commerce, and politics. Fast forward to the new century, and we hear little about propaganda, but a lot about spin. Take Phil Davies' former employer, the New South Wales government.
They got away with spin for a long time. They won election after election handily, and now it's all catching up with them because people simply do not believe what they say.
That was the beep for the toll, was it?
That's the toll.
Yeah. Talking about the New South Wales government, that was one of the things they did, wasn't it? Now, you worked for them, of course.
I was, for a little bit under a year, one of the senior media advisors to the Deputy Premier of New South Wales. John Watkins was a very good person, probably the best bloke.
You haven't got to spin it now, you know.
Well, he was. I wouldn't have worked for many of them. I did it for a while. I did the best I could, but I was 37, 38, and those jobs are designed for younger people who live closer into the city and don't have kids. But a great experience. For the first time ever, I actually saw the machinery harnessed at the government's disposal to run its media strategy. When I was working for the union and we were trying to kick in the heads of the New South Wales government, usually justifiable from where I was sitting, over better safety laws or trying to put pressure on that government to get James Hardy to do the right thing, there was, you know, countless times I had to attack the state Labor government and attack them hard. And I had no idea back then the forces that were arrayed against us, the resources. I can, you know, we on our side, we had me and Andrew Ferguson in two different cars talking to each other on the mobile, flipping between radio news stations, trying to catch our story on the news. You listen to 2GB, I'll listen to 2UE, and we'll hear how it goes. In the government, you get a text message every time your issue is mentioned on talkback radio. You can ring a guy and they will email you as many radio grabs on your issue as you like. If you've got a problem, you've got a bad story coming out the next day, there's a whole protocols and processes around how to manage that.
In their heart of hearts, politicians know that people despise spin. It's why, when the latest Premier of New South Wales came to power, promising to give it a red-hot go, he also promised no more spin. It didn't work out like that. It rarely does.
The Sydney Morning Herald Diary, 7th of May, 2009. Nathan Rees's No More Spin promise is looking even weaker with the news that Walt Secord, the master spinner from former Premier Bob Carr's office, is returning to Macquarie Street as Chief of Staff to the Treasurer. Secord was famous for pushing his trolley of truth around the press gallery. With former Carr Chief of Staff Graham Wedderburn back in Nathan Rees's office, it seems the old firm is getting ready to spin the 2011 poll.
I've noticed in the Sydney Morning Herald the other day, and if you can believe what you read in the Sydney Morning Herald these days, they were attributing the return of Graham Wedderburn, who's the master of spin under the previous Carr government, as attributing that to a slight increase in the overall news polls for the current Rees government. I'm sceptical of that assertion because I think the state Labor government in New South Wales is completely dead in the water. They've lost public support. But there's one analysis that in fact suggests the complete opposite, that in fact spin does work. And tragically, I do think it does.
Ross Coulthard is an investigative journalist with Channel 7. In 2008, he won the highest award for his profession in Australia, the Gold Walkley.
I think in the years of the Carr Labor government, the media did become grossly complacent. We didn't ask, for example, enough questions about the overall cost of the Olympics, the costs of that infrastructure, which we're still bearing today, which I think has a bearing on why we can't afford transport infrastructure in this city at the moment.
And of course, the Premier himself was an ex-journalist, wasn't he?
Yeah, exactly.
So he knew what he was doing.
He knew what he was doing, and it was all about short-term political survival.
Hello. Yeah, good, good. A bit underslept, but broadly pretty good. I'm sitting in all day. I could record some stuff for you, or equally, if you can get someone there for 5 minutes, they could probably just park a dictaphone at the lectern and no worries. See you there. Bye-bye. I think the whole concept of, you know, investigative reporting is all but dead. But in that, Nick, there's a little bit of an opportunity for people like me, because if I can credibly resource a journalist, and here, and this is where your reputation is critical, if I can get them the information they need to get a story up, then I'm sort of like a conduit, just simply because the media increasingly doesn't have the resources to go out and look for this material themselves.
While newspaper journalism is contracting, advertising has also been changing. To some in the industry, old-fashioned ads, the type that appear on our TV screens about every 10 minutes, may well be past their use-by date. Meanwhile, new jobs are appearing in the persuasion business, and along with new job titles, there's a new language. Matt Jones describes himself as an experiential marketer.
It's a name that makes a point, and the point is that increasingly the smartest brands today are the ones that are focused more on the experiences that they create. Increasingly, I think those strong brands, those powerful organizations, are realizing it's not just about consumers. It's about their employees. It's about anyone who has any kind of impact on the health of that brand, of that organization over time. And smart brands increasingly are engaging all of those people, rather than saying, well, the only people who matter to us are the people who have dollars in their pockets to buy us, and everyone else is sort of second class. So I guess to sum up what I do, it's help brands think holistically about the way that they are being experienced, holistically by all of their stakeholders, not just their consumers.
Before joining the Jack Morton Company in Sydney, Matt Jones worked for a political brand, the British Conservative Party, where image building went way beyond the ads that appeared in election campaigns. Starting as a speechwriter, he rose to be chief political advisor, responsible for setting the party's language, its tone, and here's that word again, its narrative. To Matt, it's not just about the ad or the way the leader dresses, his haircut, his eyebrows, the way he speaks. Experiential marketing aims to cover everything. There can be literally thousands of touch points.
Sometimes those touch points are quite remote. They're the knocking on a door and the conversation that's had by a 74-year-old volunteer. And a political party that's going to be successful finds ways to propel its message, not just directly, but indirectly and through all sorts of different ways.
We have a proud record of welcoming people from 140 different nations. But we will decide who comes to this country and the circumstances in which they come.
For a moment in time, and that moment was actually quite long, the John Howard brand worked. I think it's a very superficial analysis of that that would seek to point the finger at one or two elements and say, well, John Howard's success was primarily because he managed to capture the language of battlers and he dressed up in a Wallabies jersey and went for an energetic walk every day. I think it's an incredibly complex set of factors that come together. Someone once said that a brand is like a bird's nest. We pick up little bits and pieces from different places. We take a bit of a speech. We take a bit of a clip we saw on the news. We take a photograph of a smirk in the paper. We take a whole range of stuff and we assemble that like a bird's nest. We sort of put it all together and layer it. And over time, that becomes richer and richer and thicker and thicker. And our beliefs about that brand become more and more set and entrenched, and it becomes harder and harder to shift them. So when we're talking about John Howard's walks, when we're talking about what he wore, when we're talking about his body language there, we're talking about one twig. And given that he did that every day and that we saw it regularly, we're talking about a lot of twigs in a very, very complex bird's nest.
Matt Jones has appeared on ABC Television's Gruentransfer, a show whose success says something about our times. Ads, like political spin, may be widely hated, but in some quarters there's a fascination. Partly, it's an interest in cracking the code, how they're trying to get inside our heads. And partly, it's the industry itself. At least some of those on the panel of the Gruen transfer have come across as cool. The ultimate act of persuasion on a channel that once turned its nose up at the slightest whiff of an ad.
Tonight's ad of the week comes from the land of the long white hangover. Just sit right back and you'll hear a tale of a fateful ship.
Dunedin Brewery Spates has come up with an ambitious plan to send a fully working pub on a 10-week voyage to London. As Dave Gooselink reports, they're after a few good southern men to go on a high seas pub crawl.
This replica Spates Ale House is being built in a Dunedin warehouse, but it's destined to end up on the other side of the world to quench the thirst of homesick Kiwis living in London.
Ads were run in the New Zealand media to recruit the ship's crew. TV and radio networks leapt on board. Bram, aren't you always a little amazed when news and current affairs and networks run something as news, which is just clearly naked advertising copy?
Yeah, and especially in the, you know, the hotbed of news that is New Zealand. No, I'm not surprised at all. In fact, the newscasters themselves, if you look at any commercial news offering or current affairs offering, they use exactly the same...
It's content.
It's content for them.
You can genuinely make the ad the news.
Yeah, and agencies are running out this full steam.
And the other thing is we make it easy for the news channels. We come up with the idea, we film it, we record it, and it's just sitting there waiting. They're like, a bit of a slow day. Sweet, we'll play this.
So the truth is the best ad is a free ad which appears in the middle of a news bulletin.
It's an interesting fora for the contest of ideas.
At the Catalyst Conference, I know Phil Davey has his work cut out. The heavyweight issues on the programme, climate change, global financial crisis, superannuation, are topics that touch everyone's lives. But ironically, they may be too serious for some of the media. During a coffee break, we meet one of Phil's contacts, journalist Andrew West from the Sydney Morning Herald.
The public, you know, it's Roosevelt all over again.
Yeah,
the public,
yeah.
And I'm not sure that the public is way ahead of political leaders on this.
Later, you know, I managed to get Andrew West to the side of the room where we discuss the often tricky relationship between journalists and PRs.
On one level, there's a very disturbing statistic that there's something like four PR people to every journalist in Australia. However, I'm not going to deny that given the shrinking journalistic budgets, the shrinking numbers of staff in newsrooms, it's become increasingly useful to know that there are at least reliable or trustworthy or no bullshit people who will say, well, I think this is a story that will interest your demographic. There's stuff that Phil gives me that has a snowflake's chance in hell of getting a run. And there's other issues to which he alerts me and says, you might consider talking to this person or this person, which can be quite useful when there are so many demands on your time. But look, we're not at the stage in Australia yet where we are in, say, Britain with the business pages, where something like 70% of the material that's generated in the business pages comes from press releases. There's this notion that this British academic has referred to as churnalism. And, of course, you know, the truly nefarious thing with everything being online is an awful lot of press releases are literally cut and pasted, you know.
That's what I dream about. That's my fantasy.
Well, yes, and I know that's the old... Yes, I know. But look, there are certain gradations of this. I think people who tend to do a lot of work for NGOs, quite frankly, in my view, tend to be rather more trustworthy than, say, a government press secretary or a corporate spin doctor.
He wants a building.
Yeah, I gathered that.
Did you? Because that structural rejuvenation thing kind of threw me.
But and all of this came out of last night.
Well, it's been brewing for a while. I mean, every time you're forced to pay credit to a predecessor, a little bit of you dies.
Yeah, but he's PM now.
I guess the thing he's wondering is, if he left office tomorrow, what would be left behind?
Nothing. We'd shred it all.
No, mate, the PM's serious. What would be his legacy?
Good, sensible government.
Oh, come on, seriously.
Okay, national schools program.
Oh, yeah, but it's a schools initiative. I mean, even we're backing away from it now.
Transport.
What about it?
National Integrated Transport Authority.
Was that us?
Yeah.
Well, there's my point. I mean, where's the plaque? Where's the canapes? Where's the snapperazzi?
It was a bit of a slow start with the Hollow Men, but by the end of that first series, it was really very good, I thought. Quite true to life. Just the mutually bewildering relationship often between government, our ministers and bureaucracies. It brought all of that out quite well. I think government is very cynical, and I struggled with that during my brief stint in government. And unless there's a strong belief system underpinning what you're doing, then it really becomes managerialism, and I think the Hollow Men kind of brought that out quite well, the utter lack of any real driving worldview that informs what you're doing.
I reckon that photo's been digitally altered.
In what way?
Well, it looks like the PM is actually in an art gallery.
He was.
I thought he hated the arts.
He never said he hated the arts.
No, but he does.
Often there was the idea about propaganda that it was like a hypodermic needle. All you needed to change people's opinions was a quick injection of information, and voila, their opinions had changed. And again, this was often derived from thoughts about Hitler and the Nazis during World War II and going back to the 1920s and World War I. In fact, a lot of practitioners in public relations and advertising and marketing and in politics know it's a great deal harder to change people's opinions.
Mark Rolfe from the University of New South Wales. Meanwhile, the old media, what some online call heritage media, is dying daily, particularly in the US. This year, politicians are increasingly jumping aboard a new vehicle to get their message out cheaply, succinctly, and without interference from journalists. Twitter is a social networking system where each single message is restricted to a maximum of 140 characters, and politicians are finding it attractive.
Well, first of all, they bypassed heritage media, traditional media, so there's no requirement to print up a press release and try and talk a journalist into believing that it might actually be important. And then also being able to control the spin of that to a certain extent. So sometimes the news goes out and perhaps it's not reported in the way that they would expect. I remember a journalist saying that they were given the couple of minutes of grab outside of Parliament House in Canberra from Malcolm Turnbull, who then picked up his phone and walked in and started twittering straight away, because he knows on Twitter he can say what he wants to say and will be more or less accepted, whereas I think with broadcast mediums you can never be fully sure that what you've said is the soundbite that you want to have heard. The election that was called in South Australia was called on Twitter. So
the Premier called it on Twitter?
Yes.
Laurel Papworth is a social network strategist, better known online as Silk Charm.
Now, one of the things, of course, is brevity. If you're going to persuade people, you need to be able to, in these spaces, grab their attention very quickly, and sometimes in a fairly dramatic fashion, and get to the point in 140 characters. You can't ramble on in a two-page press release. You've got to do it in a sentence or two.
But there are also pitfalls with it, something, because as with anything, there's an etiquette. And is there sometimes a feeling then that powerful people, politicians, are misusing, are going against the spirit of Twitter?
We give politicians a certain amount of leeway, and anybody who's famous. So the really, I guess, you know, if I message Demi Moore, who's Mrs. Kutcher on Twitter, I won't necessarily expect a response from her.
Once, while I was giving a talk on journalism, one of the students piped up with the line, "All news is propaganda." At the time, I argued that this was just a little too pat, and the truth a little more complex. But I also had an uneasy feeling in the back of my mind. Because it's true that one of the persuaders' greatest triumphs in recent years has been the EPK, the electronic press kit, manufactured news stories slickly produced by corporations. Originally, EPKs only made it into small regional TV news bulletins. Today, it's a different story.
What's happening now, though, is those electronic press kits are finding their way into mainstream journalism, and you see it very often across not only commercial media, but including the ABC, where you'll see health stories regularly coming from EPKs. And I know that because I've seen the same EPKs myself.
Still, as a professional persuader, the competition to get your story across can be intense. Towards the end of my 2 days with Phil Davey, I have a feeling it might go badly. Although the conference he was promoting had a range of good speakers, there was no obvious hook for the media, no minister with a major announcement. And although his contact, Andrew West, did attend the conference for 2 days for the Sydney Morning Herald, he didn't have any stories in the paper.
Well, I was like you, I was despairing, Nick, I have to say, because I thought this was going to be a terrible case study of my my skills at work. But we have clawed it back. We got multiple radio interviews around the conference. So, for example, Cheryl Curnow spoke on Radio National. Sarah Hanson-Young, the Green senator who was addressing the conference, spoke on 2UE's morning show. Gary Weaven did some radio as well. We also did remarkably well, I think, in the more cerebral, I suppose you'd call it, print media. For example, an opinion piece that ran in The Age. And we've had a number of articles in The Fin, three in fact.
This year I've been talking to people all over Australia, including back here in this part of country Queensland where I grew up.
I've been to cities that never closed down.
Make us an offer! Read us this! Think about it! Stolen agreement seized! Make it direct to the public!
Increasingly, it's all too easy to feel surrounded, to be inundated with messages. It can be a voice.
In a city held hostage by winter, one man will rise to lead.
It can be a message from Scientologists.
Now, Scientology contains then a direction.
Via letterbox and phone, I've received hundreds of messages from L. Ron Hubbard and the Scientologists over the last 10 years. They never give up. And as the ABC carries more advertising, we're all constantly encouraged to embrace the brand.
I've got you under my skin.
I remember as a child sitting with my father, watching TV as he mimicked the dialogue on commercials. Little girl to mother washing up in the kitchen. Mummy, mummy, why are your hands so soft? Mother looking down, smiling. Darling, that's the magic of fairy liquid. And then my father would make a retching sound.
I've got you under my skin.
While old and new media converge and clamour for our attention, they daily present us with new challenges. Increasingly, the lines can blur. Propaganda, persuasion, promotion, PR, spin can overlap. And there's another thing. We're not only challenged to look and listen, but to become fully paid-up persuaders ourselves.
Everybody has to be a persuader today. We're all responsible for our brand of one. And I speak to recruitment companies quite a lot who are frustrated with Generation Y, who walk in and say, no, I don't have a CV. You can read my blog that I've been writing for the last 3 years, and you can look at my LinkedIn testimonials, and you can look at my Facebook page, and you can look at my Twitter account and see who I'm connected to. Because when you understand what I've been writing about, who I'm connected to, what my social network is like, then you understand who I am. And they say, actually, we just want a one-page CV from you. So I think there's this perception now that you have to be a brand of one. You have to manage your own reputation online. I did a project with someone where if you Googled a young man's name, the first couple of pages that came up against his name was the fact that he had killed his father accidentally in a car crash. And forevermore, when he applies for a job and an employer Googles him, that is the thing that he will have to at least mention in a job interview. And I think that's quite scary for the older generation. The younger generation has just simply accepted that that's the way the world is, and they've moved on.
Wake up!
Advertising is based on one thing, happiness.
Under my skin, and I love you under my skin.
On 360, here on ABC Radio National, abc.net.au/rn, The Persuaders featured Phil Davey, Matt Jones, Mark Rolfe, Laurel Papworth, and Ross Coulthart. Sherry DeLeese read from Vance Packard's bestseller, The Hidden Persuaders. The TV extracts were from Mad Men, The Gruen Transfer, and The Hollow Men. The film clip was from Thank You for Smoking. Other readings were by James Carlton, Tony McGregor, Tom Morton, Sharon Davis, and Catherine Franey. Research was by Lance Richardson, with archives research by Sabrina Lipovich and John Spence. Sound engineering on The Persuaders was by Stephen Tilley, and the program was written and produced by Nick Franklin. You can find out more information about The Persuaders on our website at abc.net.au/rn/360, where you can also give us your thoughts. How are you making sense of the truth in this sea of massaged information? And have you had any experiences at the hands of The Persuaders? We'd love to read your thoughts and stories in our guest book. Just go to the Have Your Say tab. And we have time now for just a couple of letters from listeners responding to Tony McGregor's recent feature, An Almost Practical Guide to Living with Queenslanders. The first one's from Canberra-based poet and arts patron, Barbara Blackman.
Saturday the 6th of June 2009. Dear 360 team, thank you for the Queenslander program, the de facto house where I began, compared with which all subsequent houses are fictitious. I can relive in them in memory, and sometimes do in my dreams, despite having revisited each and found them remade by subsequent owners. The coach house become the Hawthorne Craft Centre, the Highgate Terrace modernised, the mud brick house gentrified, my parental home iconified. Only the St. Lucia Queenslander survived. I know this from Brett Dean, whose parents still live next door, and fraternise with their neighbours. I have commissioned Brett to do a work on St. Lucia for sentimental reasons. Lucia is to be a cello. I felt delighted to be listening in such good old company. You, Brent, well-remembered Claudia, and Gretchen, who had a singer there within her all the time. Keep up the good work. Barbara Blackman.
Barbara Blackman's letter to us was read by Jane Ullman. Sean wrote in our guestbook, I've sharehoused through a few Queenslanders and can relate to the nocturnal rustlings. You do learn to live with a whole range of bumps in the night. One big house that a few of my mates lived in was particularly raucous. Whenever someone was busted with a girl staying over, and you'd get busted because the walls were only one plank of pine thick, no matter how quiet you tried to be, it was customary to jump up quickly and put on Eye of the Tiger on the stereo, full volume. It was then a matter of laissez-faire, if you could. Needless to say, no one would hear anything more, whatever you decided to do. Thanks, Sean. And to everyone who wrote in, you can find the audio of An Almost Practical Guide to Living with Queenslanders on the 360 website, abc.net.au/rn/360. Studio production today was by Nicole Steinke, with technical production by Manny Wasserstrom. Next week, we're starting a new series of very short radio pieces. The Secret Life of an Australian Mother is a domestic mini-opera in 6 chapters. It's made by a couple of parents who were tired of reading smug advice about how to raise the perfect child and just wanted to stuff their kids in the dirty washing basket and sit on the lid. I'm Brent Clough. Hope you can join me next week here on ABC Radio National for the full verite hysteria and chaos of family life. See you then.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.